This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Russia is on a roll. We've seen its influence rising in Eastern Europe, in Syria, in Libya, in the Balkans. Today we're going to talk about Afghanistan. We'll talk with Trumpet writer Anthony Chibatawe about what looks like yet another theater where Russia is using its resources very smartly, very strategically, in order to undermine America and put more pressure on Europe. When Britain handed control of Hong Kong over to China about 20 years ago, China promised that Hong Kong would have a high degree of autonomy. Those were the exact words in the agreement. Well, the Trumpet said this was a massive mistake. It was actually a fulfillment of the prophecy of Britain losing its sea gates, and said China was going to use this to extend its power over Asia. Trumpet writer Kieran Underwood is going to talk to us about Hong Kong's recent election. That gives us a good idea of just how complete China's control over this strategic territory has become. In the United States, the confirmation process for the next Supreme Court justice is underway, and it's really turning into quite a nasty battle in Washington. We're going to talk with Trumpet writer Andrew Miller about how this process is shaping up for Neil Gorsuch, the nominee of Donald Trump, and what this process tells us about America today. And I'm going to conclude the program by giving you some priceless advice for succeeding at your most important career. This is all on today's Trumpet Hour. Russia's rise under Vladimir Putin has been remarkable. At the Trumpet, we've reported diligently on how Russia has been grabbing territory in Eastern Europe. We've spoken recently on this program about Russia's influence in Libya. Last week, we talked about its influence in the Balkans. Recent evidence shows that Russia's influence in Afghanistan is deeper than what has been generally publicized. Obviously, this is a country that the United States has invested a tremendous amount of resources into in the more than 15 years since 9/11. But Russia looks like it's working to undermine America's interests there. Trumpet writer Anthony Chibatawe has written an article about this for thetrumpet.com. Hello, Anthony.
Hello, Mr. Hilliker.
So it was at a recent Senate Armed Services Committee hearing that the depth of Russia's involvement was first revealed, or this major statement that came out. Maybe you could just tell us about that.
In your introduction, you mentioned Russia's involvement not just in Afghanistan, but in Europe and in Africa. And that is significant, but a lot of people are somewhat familiar with that. But then they do the math and they compare United States influence in those countries. Look at Afghanistan. The United States has thousands of troops in Afghanistan, and Russia probably doesn't have anywhere close to that. But it's still doing a lot of significant damage, as this general explained, it's funding the Taliban. So maybe before we get more into what Russia is doing in Afghanistan, I think it's helpful to just zoom out a little bit and just get the bigger picture of what Russia is doing in the Middle East in general. Russia's President Vladimir Putin has said that the demise of the Soviet Union was the greatest geopolitical catastrophe of the century. And ever since then, in fact, When Putin came into power 18 years ago, that's what he has been working to fix. He has been working to resurrect the Soviet Empire, and he's had 18 years to do that. And 18 years is a lot of time. Imagine an American administration that goes on for 18 years. That's right. Enough time for it to accomplish pretty much all its goals to a point that it virtually becomes impossible to replace those policies or repeal them or reverse them in any way. So Putin has had that time, he has had that power, and he has had the audacity to step into the Middle East, especially the chaotic war zones in the Middle East, Why chaotic? Because it makes his job a lot easier in Libya and in Syria and now in Afghanistan. When the United States invaded Afghanistan in 2001, its main target was Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. And the United States was largely successful in dislodging the Taliban from power back then. But now let's fast forward 16 years. Afghanistan is now America's longest war ever. Mm-hmm. And the Taliban now has more power and more territory than it possessed when the U.S. toppled it back in 2001. And by some estimates, the Taliban now controls 43% of the country and 38% of the population. And now we're just learning that Russia has had a big hand in the success of the Taliban. As you mentioned at that Senate hearing, General Curtis Scaparotti, who is America's leading military official in Europe, of course, he's working under NATO, he said that he has seen the influence of Russia of late. And he said that Russia has increased its influence in terms of association and perhaps even supply to the Taliban. And one analyst said that that candid pronouncement was the United States' first significant official statement about Russia's deepening relationship with the Taliban. So as you mentioned in the introduction, Russia's involvement is a lot deeper than the United States has previously publicized. And it is important for our listeners to realize that even though Russia may not have as many troops in these regions, even though it's not spending the billions that America has spent, what it's doing is significant enough to worry the United States and to essentially give the victory to the Taliban after 16 years.
Well, yeah, you wrote an article some time ago in The Trumpet about Afghanistan being what you called a graveyard of empires. Obviously, Russia famously fought and lost a battle there that was extended over quite a long time and went home because of America's involvement in the situation and beating back Russia's effort to extend itself into that country. So we have, in some ways, what looks like somewhat of a role reversal here, where the United States has been trying to accomplish what the Soviet Union was unable to. And you have Russia, according to the testimony of this general before the Senate Armed Services Committee, saying that Russia is actually providing material aid. What sort of evidence did he give? He said that they were helping the Taliban, perhaps even supplying the Taliban. Russia actually denied what he said. But what evidence does he have to back up just how deep Russia's involvement has been?
I'm not entirely sure if he has tangible evidence that he provided, because even in his the wording that he used, he said perhaps even supply of the Taliban. So he didn't offer a lot of tangible evidence, but there is evidence that abounds, and Reuters reported a little bit of that. Reuters interviewed some Taliban officials who acknowledged that Russia has been funding them since at least 2007. So perhaps Russia is taking on a different kind of approach. Instead of sending troops with Russian uniforms, it's getting into Afghanistan via the Taliban, just like in Syria it has worked through Assad, and in Libya it has worked through General Haftar. So I suppose the lesson that Russia has learned from its debacle back in the late 80s is that, well, maybe this time we have to use proxies, we have to use less money, we have to do so in a somewhat indirect way, but still getting involved, which is what they are doing.
So the testimony of the general before the Senate, it actually is giving us maybe one piece of the puzzle of what Russia has been doing here. But there's actually, in some ways, you mentioned a Reuters report here, but then there are some ways where Russia's involvement in Afghanistan is actually quite out in the open. It's been, it staged one conference that was aimed at trying to bring the situation there to a conclusion. It's planning another one within just a couple of weeks here. Tell us about its diplomatic efforts.
Just going back to Russia's relationship with the Taliban, the general suggested that the Russians are supplying weapons and maybe financial assistance to the Taliban. We don't know much about that. But another way Russia has been engaging with the Taliban is to bring them into these negotiations that Russia has been spearheading at the expense of the United States. Russia is now the chief negotiator in this conflict, conflict in Afghanistan. And it's trying to bring in the Taliban into those talks. So that's one other way Russia has been meddling into Afghanistan and engaging the Taliban. And it has had these different meetings with these different nations about that. And the first few of those meetings, they didn't even involve the United States. But this last time, or this meeting that they'll have in mid-April, they invited the United States, but the United States understandably refused to participate.
Like it would basically be acknowledging Russia's legitimacy in spearheading those kinds of talks. It is interesting. I mean, it seems like here's another instance where Russia recognizes the limits of America's power, that America, for a long time, I mean, under the Obama administration, certainly, but nothing really has changed. It seems like Americans really don't have the stomach to have a presence in this country. Why are we even over there here? It's been, as you mentioned, nearly 16 years that this has been going on, and we want out. Russia sees an opportunity, but for the United States to be essentially by not participating in this, it is, even though it is saying, well, Russia doesn't, we don't know what they're trying to accomplish there, we're not going to participate and acknowledge Russia's legitimacy. In a sense, they're pulling back in a way that's opening the door for Russia to be able to do this.
It almost seems like no matter what the United States does, its influence is going to be undermined by Russia, and Russia is going to increase its influence, whether the United States attends these meetings or tries to work with Russia to come up with a solution. In the end, Russia is going to come up on top. If they just leave Afghanistan to Russia, Russia is still going to come up on top because it's engaging with very critical nations in that region: China, Pakistan, India, and Iran. And there have been reports of the Chinese army in Afghanistan, and Pakistan is working a lot in Afghanistan. I believe that they've been engaging, the Pakistanis have been engaging the Taliban, try to get them more involved. So Russia is really, this is not a small conference. This is a big conference with big players who have a big influence in the region.
Now, you put this together with all of these other things. We had a long discussion last week in our week in review about the Russian influence and rising presence in the Balkans. And we've had discussions about Libya, just how much pressure this puts on Europe. Now, Afghanistan and America have, through this 16-year period, pretty well been aligned. America with NATO troops and with European troops. We've talked about Germany's presence in Afghanistan. This really, it seems to me like we're talking about yet another situation where Europe is being, where Russia is kind of putting Europe on the back foot, and Russia's presence would have to make Europe uneasy. How much of a conflict is there between Russian interests and European interests?
Well, to start off, Europe does see that America is losing Afghanistan. That's very clear for everyone to see, hopefully. So Europe sees that, and they see Russia's success, and they realize that we have to do something about it. They are already, the Europeans are already in Afghanistan. They have the troops in Afghanistan under NATO, about 4,000 troops that under NATO. They are European Union troops that are in there. So Europe has a strong interest in what's going on in Afghanistan because Afghanistan has become a source of migrants that have been going to Europe, and Europe considered that a big concern. So big that Europe last year, in October last year, pledged $3.7 billion a year for 4 years. They've pledged to give that money to Afghanistan so that Afghanistan takes back its migrants, the migrants who are going to Europe. Afghanistan takes them back, and Europe gives them all this much money. So that's a big concern for Europe, not to mention all the other terrorist attacks that are going on in other places. Russia experienced one, and there's a good chance that that terrorist attack occurred because of what Russia is doing in these countries. So that obviously concerns Europe, because that can also happen to Europe. So we are seeing the beginning of a potential clash between these two powers, or at the very least, we are seeing Europe beginning to take more action to confront what America is neglecting and what Russia is doing in place of the United States.
We've been talking with trumpet writer Anthony Chabotterway about Russia's involvement in Afghanistan. He's written an article you can find on thetrumpet.com. It's called Russia's Designs for Afghanistan Run Deep. It's really quite extraordinary to look at this in light of all of these other situations that we've been following, where Russia seems to be leveraging quite a lot of influence with very little investment. You really do have to hand it to Vladimir Putin for the way that he deploys his resources very strategically in order to accomplish Russia's interests. Here's yet one more situation to keep our eyes on, watching the rise of Russia. We appreciate your time there, Anthony.
Good to be here.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Hong Kong was a British colony for over a century and a half, apart from a brief period under Japanese rule during World War II. But in 1997, the British handed control of Hong Kong over to China. This was one of the last items of the former British Empire to be dismantled. And when that occurred, China promised Hong Kong would enjoy, quote, a high degree of autonomy for 50 years. Well, what does that mean exactly? The people of Hong Kong are learning what a high degree of autonomy by Chinese standards really is. To talk about this, we have via Skype from our British office, trumpet writer Kieran Underwood. Hello, Kieran.
Hello. How's it going?
Oh, it's going great. It's good to have you on here. Let's start by going back to 2014. It was at that time that China said that the people of Hong Kong could hold an election, but there were definitely strings attached here. Tell us about it.
Yeah, well, as you said earlier, they were promised a high degree of autonomy. And in China, that probably means to them a different thing than it means to someone in the U.S. So they'd been having these pseudo-elections, the ones that we still see now, where 1,200 people out of the 7.3 million people in Hong Kong get to vote on who they think should be the leader. At the time, a lot of people wanted to change the system. They wanted to have direct voting for their leader. So China set up this plan.
Well, before we get to that, you said 1,000 people could vote out of the 7.3 million. How do they select their? That's a pretty small electorate among the populace. How do they select these folks?
These 1,200 people are kind of what you would call the elite. a lot of them are just establishment establishment politicians, or they have links to Chinese businesses. So there are a few people in this 1,200 who are not friendly to Beijing, but a lot of them are just the chief businessmen, and they have a vested interest in voting for China because they'll get all the benefits that China can give them.
They're called representatives of the people, but the people actually don't have any say over who those individuals are?
No, they don't. And these 1,000 out of 1,200 people we saw in this recent election, that 777 of them voted for what the Chinese wanted, their leader to be. But if you look at the polls are saying that at least 50% of people wanted another person to be their leader. So it's definitely not representative of the people.
Okay, so 1,200 representatives of the people who don't actually represent the will of the people. And going into this election here back in 2014, quite significant protests within Hong Kong saying, we've got to change this system. So then what happened in this recent election? How did China ensure that it got the results that it was seeking?
Well, in 2014, Mrs. Carrie Lam, which is the lady who got elected in 2017, she in 2014 was told to lead this new system where they would allow all the citizens to vote. The only problem was that everyone would be able to vote after the 1,200 representatives had chosen the two or three people that they could vote for. Mm-hmm. So the plan is, okay, you can vote for whoever you want. Actually, just kidding. You can only vote for who we want you to vote for. So the umbrella protests, which is what they ended up calling these protests, because people started to shield themselves from tear gas that police were trying to break up these huge protests, were shielding themselves with umbrellas, so it was called the umbrella protests. These umbrella protests became so large that they had to scrap this new system. They rejected the new system, and then 3 years later, we end up with the same 1,200 electors as before. And guess who gets elected? Mrs. Carrie Lam, the one who led the pseudo new election process.
Okay, so they took a stab at it. The Chinese got uncomfortable. The people were getting unruly. So we end up with the same exact system that we had before, and the same exact, the individual that proved that she's beholden to Chinese interests.
Exactly right. People did not want to. The reason they rejected this new system, even though everyone could vote, is because they knew that the only thing it would do is just give legitimacy to an election process which was not democratic at all. Mm-hmm. So they completely reject it and would rather have a process where clearly the Beijing representative gets elected to be their leader, but at least they can tell the international community this is clearly not democracy.
So we're learning what a high degree of autonomy looks like in Hong Kong based on a Chinese definition. And after the election, more evidence showing just how heavy-handed Chinese tactics are in securing the kind of support that they want from Hong Kong. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, this is an interesting one. You can guess about it. You can't be exactly sure, but you can be pretty sure about you can be quite sure about it. What happened was, the day after Carrie Lam was elected or selected, nine leaders from these umbrella protests, those protests in 2014, were arrested. So the day after she gets elected, the day after Beijing gets her the person they want in, 900 days, over 900 days actually, after their offenses, they get arrested. So this is like, okay, we're going to wait for about 3 years. And then as soon as we get the lady we want in power, we're going to arrest these people for crimes, apparently, that were committed around 3 years ago.
Now, Hong Kong, as much as they, the people of Hong Kong say, well, we want it to be obvious to the international community what's happening here, rather than legitimize a farce system that produces a candidate with, you know, the pretense of popular support. We just want it to be absolutely clear. And yet, who is coming to Hong Kong support? Hong Kong doesn't exactly have a lot of other nations that are willing to stand up to China. China, we've been talking quite a lot in recent programs, and we've been seeing this kind of steady march toward a preponderant power that China has within Asia. It doesn't have a lot of detractors, or it doesn't have a lot of people who are willing to do anything about it. Who's going to come to Hong Kong's defense?
Well, only the people are working for their own defense. You're not going to see Japan. You're not going to see South Korea. You're not going to see America. You're not going to see Britain, who gave up Hong Kong to them about 20 years ago. You're not going to see them coming to the aid of about 7.3 million people who want a proper election. No one's gonna risk a war with China, a major power, just to create some more democratic elections. I mean, America does not have the will to do that. And none of the surrounding nations are even in a remote position to do anything like that.
This really does recall some of the articles that we wrote around the time that Britain surrendered Hong Kong to China. We had articles back in 1997 when this was first decided. Ron Fraser, I think it was actually a cover story, January 1999 edition, called Facing the Dragon. And just he was talking about how, there were discussions at that point about the United States pulling its support back from Taiwan, and just how China was going to, at some point, be able to take over Taiwan. And we've seen development on that front. But he was talking about just how the way that Hong Kong was treated and the way that China was basically trying to cement its control over Hong Kong, that was kind of a stepping stone to being able to gain control over Taiwan eventually. Now, both of these territories, which had been formerly very closely aligned with the interests of the United States and Britain, have since been abandoned. China's basically their power over Hong Kong has been proven to be quite absolute by this point.
Yeah, quite absolute. The high degree of autonomy is pretty much laughable. Which is the same goes for the Taiwanese one China policy, which is pretty much laughable, and which President Donald Trump brought up about a couple of months ago when he first came in to his presidency. He said, well, of course, I mean, this policy is ridiculous and America should know that. But of course, they're not going to do anything about it.
I just want to read a couple of quotes from this article by Ron Fraser, January 1999, Facing the Dragon. He says, Chinese strategy appears to be geared toward control of the sea lanes, the vital trade lifelines crucial to major export economies such as Taiwan and Japan. And he's talking about several sea lanes around the world, but he says the U.S. sellout of Taiwan is not only a great betrayal of a staunch ally, it is the prelude to great disaster, like the silly dove Britain handing over Hong Kong, one of its final great strategic sea gates in the East. The U.S. is turning its back on its only possible remaining stronghold in East Asia, from which exists the prospect of containing a dedicated arch enemy. I mean, really, putting the whole picture of what's happening, Taiwan, Hong Kong, and China's influence over them, having the United States and Britain surrendered sovereignty of those areas to China, we really see the fulfillment of a dramatic prophecy that we've drawn quite a lot of attention to over the years about the loss of sea gates on the part of the United States and Britain. We see how this is contributing to China's rise. Maybe you could just talk a little bit about how significant Hong Kong is for Chinese interests, why it's so strategic, why it was important to Britain, and why China really won such a prize in gaining control over it.
Well, it was important for Britain because it is a deep water port. So if you're going to land in China from one of your ships, Hong Kong will be a place where you can do it. All around the world, the most populous cities are usually the ones that have deep water ports where you can go in. All the trade comes through there, so that's why the British like Hong Kong, and that's why China likes Hong Kong now. They have 7.3 million people there in a really small amount of land, but it's a business hub because it used to be run by the British. People flocked there. Businesses set up there. Trade was done through there. They provide a lot of services. So they really do provide a lot. And if China can get control over that, well, that's just even more beneficial for them.
One more quote from Ron Fraser. He said, "We can't forget the significance of the return of Hong Kong to China after decades of British rule. Not only did the British develop this superior natural harbor, they cultivated the economy, which now benefits the Chinese." And he quotes Ministry of Defense saying, "Never before has so much used by so many gone for so little." So it really has been quite a disaster. From Britain's standpoint, what Hong Kong's fate, we've seen it unfold here in this recent election. We appreciate you bringing this to us, Kieran. We've been talking with trumpet writer Kieran Underwood about Hong Kong's recent election and how China really took control of it. He's written an article on the subject, "What Does an Election Without Voters Look Like?" referring to the fact that the 7.3 million people of Hong Kong were represented by less than 1,200 electors in order to secure China's desired result for that election. But you can read that article on thetrumpet.com. Kieran, we appreciate you bringing that to us. Thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
In the United States, Senate Republicans say that by this Friday, Neil Gorsuch will be confirmed to the Supreme Court, filling the vacant seat of Antonin Scalia. The only problem is that the exact process for getting him there is turning out to be quite ugly. Senate Democrats look like they're going to filibuster Gorsuch's nomination, which means that in order to confirm him, the Republicans are going to have to change the rules in quite a dramatic way. If you're unfamiliar with America's judicial system, this might not hold a lot of interest, but this really is quite an amazing picture of just how divided America has become, how partisan Washington has grown, how ideological the Democratic Party has become. And to talk about this, we have trumpet writer Andrew Miller here with us. Hello, Andrew.
Great. Thanks for having me.
So start by just giving us a clear, concise explanation of what's happening this week and why it's so significant.
Right. Well, to put it in a nutshell, probably President Trump's two biggest campaign promises were to clamp down on illegal immigration and to appoint a constitutional originalist to the Supreme Court. He's made good on that second one so far and appointed Neil Gorsuch to the Supreme Court, who's probably one of the only four dyed-in-the-wool constitutional originalists who've been appointed in the past 30 years. And so really good choice for the job, someone who will put what the law says above what he would like it to say. Although there are several, pretty much the entire Democratic Party is more taking the standpoint that the Constitution should be a living document that changes with the times, and the judge should be able to read some of his own feelings into it. And so during all the confirmation hearings they've had this week, the Democratic Party, including their majority leader, Chuck Schumer, has come to the point that Gorsuch is not an acceptable candidate because of his originalist viewpoint. And so they've decided that they'd like to filibuster the the nomination. And for what that means is basically for the Senate to the Senate has to confirm the president's nominee. And it only takes a simple majority, 50% plus one, to get that done.
And the plus one could be the vice president.
The plus one can also be the vice president. So now if the Democrats want to stop that, there is a procedure that they can filibuster it, which is basically you get one of your senators to stand up and talk and don't stop talking until the work day's done and the session's closed and you can never have a vote because someone was talking the entire time. And so the normal procedure for overturning a filibuster is it actually takes 60% vote of the Senate to say, okay, end the filibuster. We're having this vote anyway. And that's basically where it looks like we're at right now. The Trump's made his nomination. The hearings are done. The Republican Party supports him. Most of the Democratic Party don't. I think there are four... There are four Democratic senators who haven't said they'll support him, but they said they won't support the filibuster. So if you can get four more Democratic senators to say we don't want to filibuster this, just they'll hold the vote and it'll be done and that'll be that. If they can't get those four, you have to try to overrule the filibuster, which you can't do. They don't. The Republicans don't have the – doesn't look like they'll have the numbers to do unless you do probably something you've heard mentioned in the news a lot, if you've been following this all, what they call the nuclear option. The nuclear option is that rule that it takes 60% majority to overturn a filibuster is not in the Constitution. That's just something that the Senate has a rule they've placed on themselves to try to make sure that there's some consensus on important nominations like this. But since the rule was made by an old Senate and it's not in the Constitution, this newly enacted Senate doesn't necessarily have to follow that rule. And they can actually take a vote to just determine that for the whole time period of this Senate, they won't be abiding by that. So it looks like one way or another, Neil Gorsuch will be on the Supreme Court unless something crazy happens. Like a week from now, but it may just be that the Republican Party has to use this nuclear option, vote to overturn the rule that it takes a 60% majority to overturn a filibuster. That way they can overturn the filibuster and just get the judicial nominee confirmed by a simple vote. So kind of complicated with the back and forth, but that's the standpoint where we're at today.
I don't want to spend too much more time on just the details of the process, but if you can, what was it that the Democrats did in 2013 that opened the door for the Republicans to be able to take the step that they would take now?
Right. Well, the nuclear option is something that has existed for – actually, this is the 100th anniversary of the nuclear option this year. In 1917, they ruled that they the Senate has the – power to not abide by that 60% filibuster overturning rule, but it hasn't really been done. For the most part, everyone wants to 60% overturn a filibuster. But during Obama's second term, they had some controversy over some of his more controversial executive branch appointments, like cabinet appointments. And they couldn't get some of his preferred cabinet members in there because the Republicans wouldn't confirm them. So the Democratic Party overturned that 60% majority rule in 2013, and they didn't abide by it, which kind of opened the doors. Before that, it was kind of seemed like, okay, well, we do have the power to use this nuclear option, but it's kind of looked down upon. And so now, since the Democratic Party used this just 4 years ago, it's becoming more acceptable in Washington to go this route.
Okay. So, first of all, let's just talk about Neil Gorsuch. You spoke about his qualifications, that he is an originalist, that this is actually something that has been an accepted standard mainstream view and approach to the law, even though there have been few who have been considered strict originalists that have been confirmed to the Supreme Court in recent decades. It's not that unusual, and there's never been a point where a man who took that sort of judicial philosophy that eliminated him from consideration. What are some of the arguments that the Democrats are putting up to say this man is not qualified, we will not support his nomination, we're going to filibuster and make it impossible for him to be confirmed without invoking the nuclear option?
Right. Well, for the most part, you'd think this wouldn't be too controversially opinion. I mean, originalism is just that we should interpret the law as it was written. And if that's not good enough, then you need to pass a new law. The judge shouldn't be the one who keeps changing the law to fit what he feels like it should be. And like I said, that's been pretty much par for the course for most of American history. It started to become more controversial in 1986 with the Bork nomination. Ronald Reagan had nominated Justice Bork, who was a constitutional originalist, to the Supreme Court, and the Senate didn't confirm him because you had those like Senator Joe Biden and Senator Ted Kennedy who were making the case that this originalism was all of a sudden a dangerous doctrine and that he was going to rule that the federal government didn't have a right to enforce states to make abortion legal. And therefore, you're going to have like abortions and all these back alleys, and they just really painted this dystopian future.
Well, that does sound kind of like similar types of arguments that you're hearing now as people are lodging these kinds of statements against Gorsuch. And you're hearing this from some Democrats, not necessarily the Senate Democrats. But it does seem like we're seeing kind of a coalescence around a few basic objections, that there are people who are saying Donald Trump was not legitimately elected to the presidency. Therefore, whoever he nominates is an illegitimate candidate. This is actually something that you've seen from some on the left. There are actually people who are saying that the Democrats, I think there are those Senate Democrats who are listening to these arguments from the more extreme areas of the Democrat Party and the more liberal aspects of their constituencies, who are saying, if I support this nomination or if I fail to prevent it, that I'm going to hear about it from these constituents. And they're bowing to that pressure from those who they want to block anything that Donald Trump does.
Right. That is, and I mean, of the four Democrats who said they are against the filibuster, they do all come from fairly conservative parts of the country.
Right.
And so there may be some political expediency to taking that position. But like I said, most of these Senate Democrats who are for the filibusters are from like parts of California and Massachusetts and New York, where their head might be on the chopping block in the next election if they don't take the position they're taking. And like I said, there's some very even high up in the Democratic Party, even Tom Perez, who was he's the former labor secretary, who was once regarded as the most left-wing man in the Obama administration. Now he's the chairman of the Democratic Party. And he was just there this week saying that Gorsuch should never be confirmed until the FBI specifically concludes that there's no ties between Trump and Russia. He's taking the standpoint that Russia hacked the election. Donald Trump is not a real president. Therefore, he doesn't have the authority to appoint a judge, and that any justice he appoints will be just as illegitimate as he is, which just raises the obvious question, is like, says even if they do use the nuclear option and get him conformed, are we going to start seeing like not my justice, hashtag not my justice protest, join the hashtag not my president protest?
I think it's a really interesting question. I mean, you're talking about the head of the Democratic Party making these kinds of assertions that everything that this president does is contingent on this, all of the allegations of Russia's involvement being cleared before we can do anything. This is how mainstream those left-wing views have become in American politics. And essentially, the Republicans are put in a position where they're saying, if you won't confirm Neil Gorsuch, which a lot of people have said, very, very mainstream candidate, who are you going to confirm? So now the Democrats are in this position where they're invoking this, they're filibustering Gorsuch. They're putting the Republicans in a position of invoking the nuclear option. Then the next candidate that comes along, they don't even have to worry about. They've basically spent the potential of a filibuster. And so then the Republicans are able to do whatever they want to do. Whoever Donald Trump decides, I want this man in office, which this is a swing vote now. If you got four on one side, four on the other, and you've got somebody like Anthony Kennedy or Bader Ginsburg replaced with a conservative or an originalist, the composition of the court changes dramatically.
Right, and it's very likely within Trump's term in office that Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Anthony Kennedy, and maybe even Justice Roberts are old enough that they'll either die or retire. Now, Roberts would be another one that where you, if you replaced him with a conservative, it would be more like maintaining the status quo. But whoever replaces Ginsburg or Kennedy could be a very almost like nation-changing of appointment to actually have the constitutional originalist in the majority on the Supreme Court. And then if you get some of these controversial rulings like Roe versus Wade, which basically says that there's a federal right that states can't outlaw abortion, which is a violation of the constitutional principle of federalism. If you overturned that based on an originalist viewpoint, that could get pretty messy if you've got...
Right, especially if you have people who are basically saying you have an illegitimate president electing individuals to the Supreme Court who have no legitimacy because they didn't pass the test, that the Republicans had to break the rules in order to put them on the bench. Then if you see rulings that you don't like, well, we're just not going to follow. I mean, it's not that difficult to see how we would arrive at the point where you had Americans openly defying court Supreme Court rulings because they didn't like the process that produced those rulings.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there were tens of thousands of protesters on November 9th and the week afterwards, right after the election, like the Not My President protest. And that's just due to election. He hadn't even done any rulings or executive orders or anything like that yet. And then the, like I said, the executive order on the travel ban elicited a lot of protest, some of them which got so big that they even shut down entire airports. And so, and then even we mentioned Tom Perez as the new head of the Democratic Party, and his assistant, Keith Ellison, who's even more radical than he is, has been given a couple speeches now saying that we need protest in every city in America to make sure that we shut Trump's agenda down. So this is something they're already calling for, is just that use street protests to shut down the new administration's policies. And so if you especially if you get like a new justice appointed using a nuclear option that's legal but a little unorthodox, you could definitely see how that could really increase tensions in the nation.
We've been talking with trumpet writer Andrew Miller about the battle over Supreme Court nominee Neil Gorsuch. This is all kind of coming to a head this week. He's working on an article on the subject for thetrumpet.com. He's going to wait until the dust has settled a little bit so that we know what happened. But it is really interesting to see what this tells us about the state of American politics and jurisprudence today. We thank you for that, Andrew. Appreciate you coming in.
Thanks.
It's time for today's last word.
Go after your family like you go after your job. The words struck as if being chiseled into my granite brain. I was talking with a man I admire deeply for his sincere devotion to God and for his exceptional family. I asked him, how do you get the balance right between family and work? I often get this question, and I've struggled to answer it adequately. It's been one of my own greatest struggles. But that advice was wonderfully clarifying. Go after your family like you go after your job. I do go after my job. It's always on my mind at some level. As I go through my day, I'm mulling ideas for articles or lectures. I'm pondering points and specifics, thinking about how to improve this publication or that class, how to better use the staff in the department. And I'm always asking God for his help in these areas. Well, being the successful head of a household requires similar passion. I've spoken to a lot of men who, like me, naturally tend to take a passive approach, sitting back and just reacting to what's happening in the family. Now, that doesn't mean not being involved, but it's being a policeman who's busting crimes or a fireman putting out flames rather than really leading the family the way that God intends. Perhaps one of the biggest tests of leadership is not just to accept things as they are, but to imagine things as they could be. A lot of men do this in their jobs. Far fewer do this in their homes. What do our families lack? Where are our families weak? Are our wives and children living up to their potential? What can we do to inspire them to achieve greater heights? With God's help, we can accomplish a lot by pursuing answers to these questions with diligent, creative thought and disciplined study. Seek out and take note of fresh ideas. Make your time together productive. Be alert to hidden aptitudes in your wife and children. Be open to new opportunities. Remember those activities that magnify your interaction with one another and that everyone enjoys. Take mental notes of negative patterns in your family's conduct. Bickering, laziness, sloppiness, wasted time. Keep a record of ideas you'd like to implement, things you'd like to change, and review it somewhat frequently. Most important, pray often, actively, in detail, with zeal, to keep God involved in all of these things. Go after your family like you go after your job. Now, it might seem overwhelming. When I go home, I just want to relax, we might say. I don't have the energy to be the big idea daddy. And that's understandable. Going after anything is more difficult than just going along. And we do need some downtime in our family time. But consider God's instruction to husbands and fathers, and you quickly see he expects a proactive, passionate effort. For our marriage, he says, husbands, love your wives even as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for it. To fathers, he says, you shall teach my words diligently to your children, shall talk about them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, when you rise up. We can't accidentally obey these commands. We have to go after them. Downtime must not completely consume family time. Our personal interests must not always supersede our family's interests, not if we're to follow God's instruction. The man I spoke with said, you can tell the difference between when you're going after them and when you're not. And I've found that to be true. There's a bright line between when I'm aware of my family's needs and actively working to fulfill them, and when I'm preoccupied with other things. I can tell when I'm leading and when I'm merely reacting. Go after your family like you go after your job. That's exactly the mindset a man needs. We need to fight our own passivity and approach our duty with energy, with drive, with creativity. Bring some passion to the job, the critical career of leading your family to a productive, enriching, satisfying, and fun life of purpose. Go after your family. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Feel free to send us your thoughts on the program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. I really want to thank my guests, Anthony Chibarwe, Kieran Underwood and Andrew Miller. Thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with this thought from William Butler Yeats. Think like a wise man, but communicate in the language of the people. Thank you for joining us. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.